Welcome to our podcast, A Presence on Your Journey. It is my distinct pleasure and honor to have as our guest Dr. Barry Prezant, who is the director of Child Care Community Services out of Cranston, Rhode Island. I just want to start by saying, what is the Child Care Community Services out of Cranston, Rhode Island?
Yeah, it's actually Childhood Community. Communication Services. It's a private practice. Mm-hmm. And it actually, I started it many years ago when I was a professor at Emerson College, because as part of my work at Emerson, I was given one day a week to do what I wanted to do. And what I've done virtually my whole career is consulting to schools and for families. So that is the private practice part of what I've done for many years, even though I've worked in a hospital and I've worked at two universities.
And that leads me to our first question, which is kind of an introducing yourself. If you can give us a brief background, or it doesn't have to be brief, but a background of yourself.
Yes. I like to say I've worn many hats in my career, and I've been very fortunate to have worn many hats because it's gotten me into a wide variety of situations and circumstances. So my career actually began working at residential summer camps as an older teenager for people with disabilities. And at the same time, when I started college, I was at a university where there was no special education and no speech-language pathology, but I was a linguistics major. So I was able to turn a lot of my coursework into understanding at that time, and we're talking about the 1968 through 72, mm-hmm. understanding what we knew at that time about children with language and communication disabilities. And I became very interested in autism very early on, because in those summer camps, I would be living in bunks with kids, some of whom definitely were on the autism spectrum, even though they didn't have those labels back then. They had the label autism, but many of those kids were not diagnosed. So long story short, I then steered my career into speech-language pathology and communication disorders and went for my master's and doctorate degree in those areas in New York State, and then went on to become a professor of communication disorders at a university in Illinois. That was my first job. I was a green PhD. And it was in this small town in Illinois where I immediately met parents, sometimes parents of children who worked at the university. And I also developed a class on autism in 1979. Then I went on to work at a hospital, Bradley Hospital, which was part of the Brown University program in medicine. And I developed a communication disorders department at Bradley back in those years, and that was 1984 through 1990. And then I left hospital due to hospital politics and funding issues and went up to Emerson College, where I started a specialty track in the master's and doctoral program on autism and childhood language disabilities. So I like to say, and for the last 15 years, I've been in private practice, mostly consulting to schools, consulting with families, even though I do that less and less now. I feel right now I'm more into working with teams in schools and trying to change systems that could be more effective in supporting children, people with autism, and their families. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of my career. When I say I've been lucky to have worn many hats, I have clearly worked with people in the trenches all these years. Matter of fact, I just returned a few moments ago from a early childhood program where I do what I love to do, and that's spend time in classrooms, observe children, meet with the school teams, and make some recommendations at that time. I've worked in a hospital setting, so I got to see the mental health medical model side of what goes on with children with special needs and children with autism. And I've also always tried to maintain connections with grassroots organizations such as Community Autism Resources, so I could always be aware of the family side, in addition to working with families, working with, in particular, CAR, in terms of the advocacy efforts, the fundraising, and, of course, the wonderful parent retreat that we all do and collaborate with the parent professionals and Community Autism Resources, not just the parent professionals, the sister professionals as well, and myself and my wife, who's a psychologist. So just to sum up, I think these varied experiences have just given me kind of a great privilege to have a unique window into all of the different situations that affect the lives of people with autism and their families and the politics that go along with that and what we need to do to be more effective in supporting children and adults with autism and their families.
Now, did your summer camp counseling experiences shape that, or how did you become interested in this whole area of communication disorders, and what kinds of disabilities did you work with at your summer camps?
My summer camp experiences had a profound impact because I was a surrogate parent. These were not day camps, these were residential summer camps, and I did that for 5 or 6 years in a row in different settings. The very first summer camp was upstate New York, and it was not a quality camp. It served children all the way up through adults with disabilities and a full range of disabilities, except for profound physical disabilities, because the camp was not designed for that, even though, of course, many of the campers had physical challenges as well. But as I mentioned, children clearly with autism, many of whom did not have that label back then, children with cognitive challenges, emotional behavioral issues. I remember the first camp I worked in, the one I mentioned that wasn't the greatest quality. There were a number of children who came from socioeconomically challenged families, and they probably didn't have developmental disabilities, but they were exposed to environmental risk, multiple foster care placements, in many cases, abuse. And back in those days, the late 60s, a lot of these kids were just all mixed together. The differentiations were not made with kids who had different kinds of challenges at that point. And the communication piece came from my interest in language. And quite simply, and I'll be very honest with you, I was going to be a German major until my German teacher, the second year of college, said to me, unless I was planning on living in Germany for a number of years, I should give up trying to be a German major, because I had problems becoming conversational. And I had so many credits in French, German, and Spanish that I became a linguistics major. And then I took a course with one of my professors called The Biological and Psychological Bases of Language, in which we were exposed to language disabilities, including aphasia in adults who lose language due to stroke, including children with language disabilities, and everything just came together in my junior year undergraduate. All my, at that point, 3 years of experiences of summer camps and being very interested in linguistics and language development and language disabilities.
In your background, it mentions that you've been, and actually you mentioned it yourself a few moments ago, that you've been almost 40 years, maybe 40 years or so, working in this area. And I'm wondering what the attitudes were like when you first started. What was it like in school systems and clinicians?
Well, in terms of autism specifically, even though there was more and more interest and more research beginning to happen at that time, there was still the great myths and misperceptions. So the year I started working in summer camps was only a year after Bettelheim wrote The Empty Fortress, in which he said cold, emotionally cold parents, especially mothers, caused autism. Now, I was very, very lucky in that I always found myself being in situations where I was with very good people. So what I mean by that is one of my first experiences as a speech and language pathologist in the early 70s was at an autism program at Buffalo Children's Hospital. And it was an excellent program. The teacher was excellent. The classroom aide was excellent. And I was this new green master's level speech language pathologist. And in many ways, that was as good a classroom as the good classrooms I go in now. So I think there's this myth that we were just in the dark ages back then. So much had to do with the quality of the people and the understanding and the approach of the people who work with kids. Now, of course, there were approaches within the United States at that time which used punishment extensively, partially based upon the work of Dr. Lovas, who eventually did a complete turnaround and said, we don't use punishment anymore. And it was very scattered. Some programs removed children from their parents based upon the Bettelheim notion that cold parents caused autism. So he actually established a school in Chicago called the Orthogenic School, in which he put the parents in psychotherapy and removed the kids from the parents. So things were scattered. My personal experience was a very positive experience with people who really understood, and even though the research wasn't there yet, we knew that these kids were neurologically different, that parents didn't cause the autism. And I work with people that I learned from who developed very close trusting relationships with parents. So I was exposed to all of that very, very early on, and it's very consistent with the approach that we believe in now, even though I do realize across the country things were very, very different depending upon where you are.
So what years are we talking about that your experiences were a little more positive than what was going on around you?
I would say early 70s. Mm-hmm. I remember one of my professors, when I was in my master's program for speech and language, one of my professors was invited to speak at a chapter of what was then the National Society for Autistic Children. It was called NSAC. Now that's the Autism Society of America. And I just got to know these parents. And I remember when we walked into the meeting, it was a monthly meeting and they regularly invited speakers in. And a dad who was the president invited me and my professor, his name was Dr. John Muma. And the first thing he said to us, thank you for coming and thank you for speaking to us about language development and how to help our children. But if you mention the name Bettelheim, we're going to kick you out on your ass. Because that was literally 3 years, 4 years after Bettelheim claimed in his now infamous book that parents cause autism. So just to see that impact on parents very early on was very, very striking to me. And it was not only striking to me, of course, it was totally wrong and inaccurate.
I wonder what brought about his turnaround.
As I understand, he never really turned around. But other people challenged him significantly. Mm-hmm. And there were other people, I don't want to say it was just Bettelheim, there were other child psychiatrists in the 50s and into the 60s who also thought it was bad parenting that caused autism.
So it was like a regular school of thought.
It was. It was a major school of thought, especially in psychiatry, especially in child psychiatry. My experience working with speech and language people and special educators was that we didn't buy into that. And I really think that's a myth. You hear a lot of people talking about the history of autism, and some of them say, oh yeah, well back then everybody thought bad parenting caused autism. And it clearly, clearly was not the case. It was, as you just said, it was one school of thought.
Mm-hmm. You're also internationally renowned or known for your work, and I'm wondering some of the experiences in other countries that you may have worked with as compared to the United States. Where do we stand in terms of our understanding of autism and the autism spectrum comparison to some of the countries you may have worked with?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have had the chance to present in a number of countries. I guess my first international trip where I really got to see programs in depth was in Taiwan in the 80s. I went with a group of people from the American Speech and Hearing Association, and in particular, they hooked me up because of my interest in autism with a child psychiatrist named Wei Tsin Tsung, who had an autism program at Taiwan National University Hospital. And once again, you know, I found a lot of what they did was very consistent with our philosophy. Back then, in the mid-80s, they did a lot with music, a lot with art. They were certainly less sophisticated in the area of communication and language development. So I want to kind of bring this back to a more general statement. And I think we have to make a distinction between what I've seen the last few years in my international travel versus 15, 20, 25 years ago. And the change has been dramatic. A number of years ago, people looked only to the United States, and it is primarily in the United States where a lot of different named approaches have developed, such as ABA, such as TEACH, such as RDI, even our model, the CERTS model. And back then, people were struggling in other countries. In many cases, in countries that were not Western countries, and I saw this in Taiwan when I was there, except for the one program, Dr. Wei Tsin Tsung's program, a lot of kids were kept at home. Schools would not accept them. And families felt very challenged and stigmatized because it was considered to be a loss of face for the family, that somehow it was a black mark on the family to have a child with autism. And a lot of these kids were not diagnosed, but some were, but still families did not feel confident in advocating for their kids. They hid their kids away. What I've discovered in the last few years, and let me just mention a few places I've been to in the last 5 years or so. I've been to 5 different cities in Australia. Last year I was in Singapore. I did a week of training in a school in mainland China, in Guangzhou, Hong Kong. We've worked with people in New Zealand extensively. Also, I've been to Scandinavia, a lot of different countries. And I'm looking forward, actually, in a couple of months, of going to Dubai and to Greece. And what's happened, I think in part because of the internet, in part because of people now traveling so much internationally and observing what's going on in different countries, I have actually found a major change in quality. I visited a school this past June in Singapore under a larger organization called the Autism Resource Center. Hold on to your seat here. This school serves over 900 children with autism. And what I found them doing was fairly sophisticated in terms of their job training programs, their job placement programs, their really understanding the need to build on strengths, on talents of kids. So they had a whole art gallery where people could come in from the outside and buy art in the school. They have a very active website. I'm not saying this is the case in all different places, but for example, in New Zealand, I was over in New Zealand 3 times in 3 years working with the Ministry of Education there. And I found them to be very sophisticated. They developed a national policy for people with autism. And they included, this is like, they started about 8 years ago, they included people with autism on all their committees. So I'm seeing a major shift in other countries. Some of them not Western countries. The school that I observed in China, which is supposed to be a model school. Now the kids weren't there. I was with the staff for a week, but I did get a chance to go to the classrooms and see the school. They were doing some very nice things. Now, of course, most of that is not happening across China yet. It's happening in little pockets.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say compared to the United States, a lot of places still have a lot of catching up to do, but they're catching up very rapidly. I've seen some things in other countries that were very impressive that we could learn from. Some countries, their whole culture is a lot more family-centered. So in New Zealand, they really understand children as a part of the family, and I've always worked closely with families, at least the people I work with in the Ministry of Education.
I was just going to ask you, are there areas that we need to catch up on?
Yeah, well, I think this isn't specific to autism. I think in the United States, people have been saying for years that we need to invest a lot more money and effort into really good early childhood education. Another interesting thing in New Zealand is that all of the children with autism, their early intervention is birth to 6, not birth to 3 as it is in 45 or 50 states in the United States. And in New Zealand, all of the kids with autism are in early childhood centers. And then the Ministry of Education comes in and trains the staff in all of the early childhood centers. So again, I'm not saying it's ideal, but they see inclusion as something that should be made available with the right supports from the get-go. And what's really interesting also is what people value. I see in some other cultures, and to some extent in Australia, to some extent, to a great extent in New Zealand, certainly in Scandinavia, there is a lot more focus on social and emotional and communication development. And there are some cultures, for example, that rejects what happens in this country under the what we call traditional ABA, just teaching kids facts to answer questions and doing things such as that. They see relationships and social emotional development as being central for all children, not just children with autism. So you can't just talk about kids with autism. You have to talk about what a culture values for all of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been crying in this country for years. You know early intervention is terribly underfunded. We know that families are not supported the way they need to be supported in this country. We have systems, but they don't always work optimally in this country, where I've seen that much better in other countries.
Prominently mentioned on your website, I hope I'm not misrepresenting, but it is mentioned several areas of your website, is a model that you and your colleagues have come up with. And I know it's very, very hard to take something that you've worked so long on and present it in such a short time, especially where there are manuals that you've developed. But I wonder if you can explain the CERTS model.
Yes, in 10 words or less. One thing that I always like to say when I begin to talk about the CERTS model is even though our manuals were published in 2006, and they're quite extensive and overwhelming to some people, and understandably so, that they're very detailed, almost 800 pages in those two manuals. The roots of CERTS goes way, way back. And I like to say, you could look at my doctoral dissertation, which I completed in 1978. My senior co-author, we have a number of co-authors on the CERTS model, my senior co-author, Dr. Amy Weatherby from Florida State University, you could see roots of the CERTS model in her doctoral dissertation in 1980, that it is a model that we developed based upon what we thought was lacking in terms of current approaches. And not that there aren't some very, very good aspects to many current approaches. As a matter of fact, we say the CERTS model is not exclusive of other strategies or approaches. It's more of a framework under which a variety of practices can be implemented. So why did we develop the CERTS model? Based upon my experience and Dr. Amy Weatherby's experience, and then people that we invited to be a part of the CERTS model, one former student of mine, Emily Rubin, a wonderful occupational therapist, special educator, who just passed her doctoral comps last week, Amy Laurent, and then a former student of mine who's no longer a collaborator, Pat Rydell. we were saying, wait a second, there's a lot of good information out there, but there's nobody standing up and saying, what do we really need to focus on? What are the domains of development that need the most attention? And that's what the acronym CERT stands for: social communication, emotional regulation, and then the TS stands for transactional support. The ways that we support children and adults with autism, the way we support families, and the way we support each other in working. So yes, there's a lot of information out there, but we felt that in terms of really prioritizing what makes a difference in the life of children and adults with autism and their families, those are the three domains that need to be highlighted. And some of this we've known for years. Social communication, of course. We've known social communication to be a priority for years, but some people don't understand what social communication is. Some people think training a person to point to pictures when you say point to shoe, point to hat, that's social communication. Well, that's one very narrow sliver of receptive communication. Social communication has to do with feeling confident in engaging other people, expressing your emotions, expressing your needs, your wants, your observations, and knowing how to share what you observe, what you think, what you need, what you want, what you feel with other people in the flow of everyday interaction. So social communication involves nonverbal behavior. It involves speech. It involves augmentative systems, speech generating devices. Any way that we could help a person share their feelings, share their observations, share their needs with others, but very much in a way that they can reflect upon their lives and communicate that to others. So we really value initiating, not just teaching a person just to respond to us. That's a very, very big piece. So I'm going to go through the other domains very quickly. Emotional regulation. I like to describe that in a very simple way. When we are well-regulated emotionally, any one of us, we are most available for learning, and we're most available for engaging successfully with other people. And I always like to say that, unfortunately, due to many, many reasons, people with autism tend to be less available for learning and engaging than many other people. And then we can consider why. Everything from sensory challenges to unpredictable changes in routines and in your life. Sometimes people with autism are less available due to other people's behavior. When we talk too much, when we talk too fast, if we touch a person too much and they don't like touch, they're tactically defensive. So we want to set up environments. We want to behave in a way and put all the right supports in place to help a person with autism to be most available for learning and engaging, which has to do with decreasing anxiety, which has to do with anticipating high-risk situations, such as a very busy, noisy, chaotic environment, and then putting all the right supports in place that help a person be able to cope. So we teach coping strategies to help a person stay well-regulated emotionally. And this goes for your 2-year-old who gets upset when a loud noise goes off at home or outside, to a 35-year-old who gets confused when a routine is changed without any warning. It's the full range. And then transactional support is simply all the supports we put in place for learning, such as visual supports, curriculum modification, all the supports that we put into place by the way we behave. Simplifying language, reading a person's signals, what we call signals of dysregulation, meaning they're getting a little anxious, they're getting a little upset, they're fearful, they're confused, and how do we respond with support to help them out in those instances? And then, as I mentioned, how do we support families and how do we support each other in our work?
I don't know how to ask this question. I'm going to try it. But would people or other professionals in autism, would they recognize this model being practiced? Would they know it if they see it? You know, I don't know if I'm asking it correctly, but would they know that this is being practiced? Or can you tell if you were to go into an organization or a center?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sometimes I'll say when I'm doing a workshop that some of what I'm going to talk about, you're already doing. And I will sometimes go into a program, for example, and let's say it's an ABA program based upon applied behavior analysis. And I see a teacher in that program, and I might say to that teacher, you're a natural CERTS person because you're doing a lot of things that are helping you be effective. And I don't know if you would necessarily be able to articulate that you're doing those things. So you might be a good teacher in terms of, let's say, teaching math or teaching science. But you also have to be very sensitive to a student's signals that they're getting a little anxious or upset and support them. you also have to be a very good support in terms of that student's ability to communicate. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you can, yes, you can go into some programs, and if you see the highest priorities being on social communication and emotional regulation, so even if you're looking at an academic task, if that teacher is in a CERTS model program, they're paying as much attention to facilitating good communication as part of the learning as they are in teaching the math. Or they are as sensitive in supporting a child's ability to be available for learning and engaging, to be well regulated. So yeah, those are the things that you have to see. But having said that, a lot of people that we see who are naturals, who really know how to engage people with autism, how to develop relationships with them, are already doing those things. So what we try to do with the CERTS model is to put in big neon lights. These are our priorities: social communication, emotional regulation, transactional support. And we feel that with good work in that area and good support in that area, you're improving quality of life. It has as much to do with a preschool classroom, it has to do with a middle school classroom, as it has to do with a workplace, as it has to do with a home, as it has to do with a community environment, group home, for example. It's not just about what goes on in an educational environment, in the narrow sense of education, like a school.
Now, does it matter whether someone is high functioning or not so high functioning? Can this model be applied across the board?
Yes. Well, with all due respect, Dennis, I keep away from the terms high functioning and low functioning. And
well, that's okay. I'm glad you're straightening me out on that.
I actually wrote an article on that, and it came out last year as part of my column in Autism Spectrum Quarterly magazine, and it's called High Functioning and Low Functioning Autism, a False Dichotomy. And the reason that's being a little bit preachy about this now is over the years, I have met many, many people on the spectrum who at some point in their lives, maybe when I met them, maybe early, were considered to be low functioning,
mm-hmm.
and people were not seeing or did not really work to build the abilities. And put it this way, if autism is partially defined as a developmental profile with peaks and valleys, some areas of particular strength and some areas of challenge and weakness, then the idea of high functioning and low functioning falls by the wayside. Because you have to say, high functioning in what? Low functioning in what?
In what, right.
In motor skills, in visual spatial memory, in music skills, in rote memory, on and on and on. And the CERTS model, in particular, we are a developmental model. And we organize our goals and objectives, because we do have a curriculum. We organize our goals and objectives in three developmental stages. And one stage is where people are more challenged in communication. They may communicate primarily through gestures and vocalizations, maybe just moving into using symbols such as pictures, photographs. Then we have a second level called, that we call that the social partner stage. Then we have a stage called the language partner stage, where people are beginning to communicate through symbols, photographs, speech, sign language. And the highest stage in communication is what we call our conversational partner stage, where people are much more sophisticated in using symbols such as speech, such as sign language, such as pictures, in, as I mentioned, communicating their thoughts, ideas, feelings, and observations. So the model is actually, by design, being implemented with very, very challenged, very, very young individuals, older individuals who may be very challenged, either developmentally challenged due to the neurological part of their disability, or maybe they just grew up in very, very bad, challenging circumstances. So I'm consulting to an agency, I'm going up there tomorrow, Sproinc in Maine, where they serve over 600 people statewide, many of them with autism, and they're beginning to move CERTS from classrooms into their group residences. So when I was there last year, I met a number of young adults who unfortunately had a terrible, terrible circumstance of being physically and in one case sexually abused growing up. And they are very, very challenged in many ways. That doesn't have to do so much with their autism as it does with their life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And CERTS is being implemented in, as I mentioned, some of those community residences because they see that it fits well under the umbrella of focusing on social communication, emotional regulation, and transactional support. So another way of putting this is we're learning about the applicability of CERTS from people who are applying CERTS. That people come back to us and say, oh, well, we're using it with this group of kids. I even heard recently that there's a school in Florida with kids who are visually impaired and hearing impaired, and they're implementing the CERTS model with many of those kids, even though they do not have diagnostic labels of autism. And we also hear from mental health practitioners that some of the principals are also effective with kids who have primarily emotional behavioral challenges, not having to do with autism at all, not even having to do with developmental disabilities.
So this model can be applied to other disabilities then, deaf and blind, for example, you just pointed out.
And thank you for saying that, because usually when we do a workshop, by the end of the first section of the workshop, let's say the first hour and a half introduction of a 1 or 2 day workshop, somebody always raises their hand or comes up to me and says, why do you call this a model for kids with autism? This is applicable to most of the kids with developmental challenges that I have. And it's just a historical artifact that this happens to be myself in particular and Amy Weatherby, our areas of expertise and research. But I'm working with a school district in Connecticut now, primarily with their quote-unquote EDBD programs for kids with emotional behavioral disorders, and I'm applying CERTS principles there, and they work. So we have to understand, when you have a model that's a developmental model that's based upon human development and child development, we're talking about human beings developing. We're not talking about, we don't believe that we should pigeonhole kids into categories and say, oh, well, what's the ADHD intervention? What's the autism intervention? What's the intellectual disability intervention? Yet, in the United States, especially based upon our history of having a medical model, if you see those, and I don't agree with this at all, but if you see each of those categories through a disease model, then you have to have the right treatment for that disease.
Right.
If you see people along a continuum of developmental strengths and challenges, as we all have developmental strengths and challenges, and you're very developmentally based, then there's no such thing as an intervention just for this group or just for this group or just for this group.
Where do you see attitudes and society heading in our understanding of autism and the spectrum, say, in the next 10 years or so?
Yeah, it's another great question. Where I hope it would be heading, but I definitely see a lot of evidence that it's heading in this direction, is looking at every individual as an individual, getting away from thinking that all we have to do is identify the challenges or the relative needs and just focusing on that, looking at the absolute positiveness of looking at every person's strengths, certainly educating the public. I mean, something just happened this past week where Autism Speaks is helping to organize this autism summit. I believe it's in Washington. And the grandmother, Suzanne Wright, who she and her husband founded Autism Speaks in 2005, as an introduction to the summit, she went on and on and on about basically how life is just hell for any family that has a child with autism. And all these kids do is keep people up at night and have tantrums all the time and on and on and on. Now, the intentions are good. They want to draw more attention to autism and raise more money for more support. But they're communicating to the public that autism is nothing but a tragedy. And yet, you know, and I know, and Kate knows, that in so many cases, you want to go to the other extreme, that a person with autism enriches the lives of other people. It's not simply a tragedy. And of course, this is not to dismiss or sugarcoat the challenges that happen. But I hope the future is heading us more and more in that direction, and it definitely is. If you look at all of the theater and arts programs that are being developed, if you look at the things that are being communicated through the media, more and more there are positive stories. So when Suzanne Wright came out with this statement, I'm sure somebody wrote the speech for her, who works at Autism Speaks, if you look the last few days on the internet, the reactions of families who have kids with autism. One family showed a beautiful picture of the family with their little girl smiling, and they're all laughing and smiling. And they're saying, is this the tragedy you're talking about? So I think we have to change public perceptions, which will change attitudes towards hiring in the workplace, which will change level of tolerance if we do see a person with autism having difficulty and saying, oh, that's a person with autism having difficulty. How can we help? As opposed to people like that shouldn't be out in public because they're not desirable to be part of mainstream culture. So I think we're definitely moving to an era. And I hear this from parents all the time. Parents saying that, you know, I'm really surprised when my child has some difficulty. Sometimes people want to help. They don't run the other way. They don't look at us as judgmentally as they used to look at us, even though that still happens. We live in a very, very judgmental culture here.
Dr. Prezant, I want to thank you very, very much. This has been, for me, very instructive. And I really, really hope that our listeners really take time to not only listen, but study it and study the things that you had to say today. And thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us here at Community Autism Resources.
Yeah. And thank you, Dennis, and thanks for the excellent, excellent questions and thought-provoking questions.
Dr. Prezant, where can we get more information about articles you've written and on the CERTS model and so on?
Yeah, there are actually two sources online. My website, which is simply my name, Barry Prezant, BarryPrizant.com. Under the resources link at the top of the page, I have different categories of articles that are available as free downloads. So under resources, you click downloads, and then there are a number of categories of articles, including my published articles in Autism Spectrum Quarterly, which I've written for about 5 years, or about 25 articles or so up there, with short descriptions of all the articles. For information about the CERTS model, you can go to CERTS.com, S-C-E-R-T-S.com. And once again, we have a number of articles that are free downloads, articles written by parents, articles written, have been published in professional journals about the CERTS model.
Thank you very much. I want to remind everybody that the music that we use on A Presence on Your Journey was written by George Winston. A Presence on Your Journey is a podcast of Community Autism Resources. Our executive director is Barbara Domain. Our producer today was Kate Danzero. And our podcasts are edited by Nicholas Domain. For more information on this and to listen to this and other podcasts, you can go to our website at www.community-autism-resources.com and listen to us there. Or if you have iTunes, you can go to the bookstore and search Autism, A Presence on Your Journey, and subscribe to a podcast there. My name is Dennis Pulselli. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.